So earlier in the episode, we heard from Rosamund and Natalia on their findings in the rat brain. But are human and rodent brains similar? Do the results really translate? I stepped out to the sunshine with another speaker at the conference to find out.
My name is Mark Cunningham, and I work at the Institute of Neuroscience at Newcastle University.
And we've been discussing earlier with Roz and also Natalia about using rats in order to try and understand more about the human brain. I mean, can you really extrapolate findings from the rat into the human?
I think you can extrapolate some features. What we've been doing at Newcastle University is trying to get around this problem by using human tissue. So this is human brain tissue that is being removed from patients primarily who are undergoing elective neurosurgery for the treatment of epilepsy. So these are patients that are not responding to conventional drug treatment, and in order to try and cure their epilepsy, so the majority of patients do respond to anticonvulsants, but there is a significant proportion, around about 30%, which don't. And in those patients, surgical intervention is a very successful intervention.
So you've got these treatment-resistant patients, and they elect to undergo surgery to take out part of their brain in order to help with treatment. I mean, how much of the brain are you actually removing?
In many of these patients, the part of the brain that is causing the epilepsy to occur is the hippocampus. And so what the surgeons and what the neurologists and neurophysiologists will do is they will essentially work out which hippocampus it is, because of course we've got two hippocampus, one on both sides of our brain. And once they've ascertained which hippocampus is bad or diseased, they will then work the patient up to make sure that even though they're removing one hippocampus, that the hippocampus on the other side can compensate and still cope in terms of memory function, because of course our hippocampus are critical for learning and memory. So, I mean, the hippocampus is quite a large structure in the brain.
So I believe it's about the size of your little finger, yes. Kind of curled up.
Yes, that's correct. And in addition, they also remove another structure, which is called the amygdala. And what's good about this surgical operation is that they don't damage other structures that are in the temporal lobe that are critical for other higher order processes.
So, I mean, the amygdala is involved in kind of fear response, and the hippocampus is involved in learning and memory, and both of these brain structures are buried quite deep down in the brain. So how does the surgeon get access to those deep areas of the brain without hurting other areas of the brain?
So when we go into theatre to obtain our samples, it's been a real revelation for a scientist like myself to actually observe these neurosurgical procedures. And what the surgeons tend to do is they do a very delicate operation where they approach the hippocampus and the amygdala through a fissure in the brain. So what they're able to do is essentially pull apart the brain tissue and go down through a sort of valley in the brain, and then they can expose the hippocampus. And then what they do is they essentially suck the hippocampus out. So they're able to selectively just suck out that area. And the tissue, we obtain some of the tissue before it's actually sucked out, and what we can then do is prepare very thin sections of that tissue, so we have these slices of brain which we're then able to maintain in an artificial environment which mimics some of the physiological features that the brain tissue would be exposed to if it was still in the intact brain. So this approach is known as the in vitro brain slice preparation. And that then allows us unprecedented access in terms of recording human brain cell activity, but also how large groups of human brain cells behave in terms of generating organized electrical activity.
And so you're not actually getting the hippocampus and the amygdala that's being sucked out, you're actually getting the slice of the cortex, so kind of round by your ears, and you're getting that slice and then putting it in a Petri dish, a glass Petri dish, and keeping it alive. How long can you keep that brain slice alive for once it's been removed from the patient?
So far, our kind of lab record is about 24 hours in which we've been able to keep the tissue viable, so alive, after the surgeon has removed it, and then still be able, in our hands, to obtain viable electrophysiological, that's the electrical activity of the brain cell, recordings in the in vitro environment.
And I'm imagining that you've got to get this bit of brain tissue quickly from the neurosurgeon's unit to your own lab. I mean, how do you manage that?
So we're very lucky in Newcastle that we have a very strong tradition of translational interface between basic biomedical science and clinical neuroscience that's occurring. And that's really facilitated by the fact that our institute is contiguous with the hospital. So when we obtain the tissue, we have about a 4-minute dash downstairs from the neurosurgery department to my laboratory. And during that time, I should mention that the tissue is in an artificial cerebrospinal fluid that we make in the laboratory that's very, very cold. So it's essentially trying to biochemically sort of put the tissue into stasis. And also this artificial cerebrospinal fluid is being continually oxygenated to keep the tissue alive. So with those conditions and a very rapid dash to the lab, we can then section the tissue into thinner slices and then sustain it alive in the in vitro environment.
So traditionally, looking at electrical activity within nerve cells, within brain cells, so that's how nerve cells communicate using electricity, usually that's been done using rat brain or mouse brain slices or even cells that have been dissociated and are in the petri dish looking at the electrical activity. So there's lots of information in neuroscience on rat electrical activity. Does it line up with the information that you're starting to get now with this human really pinpointed electrical activity readings?
Certainly there are some features in terms of organised electrical activity which are matching up, but we've also discovered novel patterns of epileptic activity that have not been reported before in rodent work. So it is revealing some new aspects in terms of subtleties with respect to the dynamics of pathological activity that is occurring in the human epileptic brain.
And what about non-epileptic brains, so humans that haven't got epilepsy? Can you manage to get some brain tissue from other people?
Well, there's obviously major ethical considerations that have to be taken place. You can't go around taking out perfectly normal bits of brain from human patients. But, of course, we do need to obtain control or comparison tissue, as it's sometimes called, which we can compare to the epileptic samples that we're obtaining. And one way that we can do this is that routinely the surgeons remove deep tumours from patients, again, who are undergoing elective neurosurgery for the removal of the lesion. And in many cases, the surgeons, in order to gain access to that tumour, have to go through overlying cortex. So we're able to get, again, very small samples of that and use exactly the same techniques that I've already discussed. And what we've been doing with these samples is, first of all, making sure that we don't see epileptic activity because they're non-epileptic comparison samples. But we've then also been able to essentially replicate some of the work that we've done previously in rodent tissue, which is where we can pharmacologically trick the brain slice into thinking that it's never left the brain, and by adding different types of neurochemicals, we can produce physiological brain waves, physiological rhythms that are known to be associated with cognitive behaviour. And what we've been doing with respect to this work is looking at how the mechanisms apply to this activity and the differences that we see compared to rodents. And there are differences. We're seeing differences in terms of how this activity is generated, and we believe that this may be due to simply the fact that the human brain has to operate on much larger scales than the rat brain. So it may simply be due to a question of scale.
So the rat brain is so much smaller than the human brain, and so there's different oscillations and electrical activity that are involved in cognition, which is thought to be kind of learning, memory, reasoning, flexibility in thinking and planning.
Reassuringly, one particular type of oscillation that we're interested in, which is the gamma frequency oscillation, it's produced in both rat brain, the rat neocortex, and the human neocortex. But the mechanisms by which it's being produced are different between each species.
And do you think this might have implications for some of the research that's already been done on rats and some of the and the way that drugs are developed to help human patients, both with epilepsy and also with problems with cognition? So, you know, people with Alzheimer's or dementia, for example.
So, with particular reference to drug discovery, there's been a real... The pharmaceutical industry has really struggled in terms of translating a lot of drugs from preclinical studies into the clinical environment. And in particular, drugs that they would like to target neuropsychiatric disease. So there have been a number of high-profile failures over the last couple of years. And my belief is that this may be due to the fact that there are these differences in terms of how the human brain generates such activity as opposed to the rodent brain. And so we need a better insight into how the microcircuits of the human brain are producing this activity in order to come up with much more refined drugs that can target this type of cognitive behaviour.
So, I mean, this seems to be phenomenal work. I've never heard of anything like this before in the field of neuroscience. Is this the first time that this research has actually been shown at a conference?
It certainly is the first time that we've presented this work at an international conference, and we're currently trying to finish off a number of critical experiments so that we can get this work published as quickly as possible.
Thanks, Dr. Mark Cunningham from Newcastle University.